Okay. Thank you, Bill. Can you hear me? Okay. Okay. Thank you, Bill, for that introduction. I would also like to say that Bill is a friend, a colleague, a comrade in this social solidarity struggle for peace and nonviolence. He's also a leader. Those of you who were at the dinner, you heard me when I said that the first time I met him, I knew that we were going to be working for a long, long, long time together. And then I need to say good evening. I need to say that. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you. I should have started by that, but thank you, Bill. And I want to thank the Resource Center for Nonviolence for being a partner with us as part of Global Majority. They have supported our efforts and we have worked together, and they were a part of sponsoring the Amman Jordan conference that Bill was talking about. I thank everybody in the Center for Nonviolence. And then I also want to say that my connection with Global Majority is just a natural, inevitable connection. The work with Global Majority continues the work for peace and peace through nonviolence. And Global Majority is just a continuation of the struggle and the achievements of South Africa, and hopefully of the world, you know, that very small little things help and they can result in peace. Or if we are not careful, if we are not active, then they will result in violence. But, you know, our objective, our focus is for peace. I was asked to come and give a perspective on Africa. I would love to talk about South Africa, and I'll do that. But I also want to talk about other parts of the world, other parts of Africa. Yeah, other parts of Africa, I would like to do that. And then I'll leave time for questions. I think it will be better if I also answer questions. I have been in the U.S. for a long time. I have been in the U.S. for a long time, but also I have a strong connection with home. I go home very often. I work with people from home, including people in government. The Consul General of South Africa, who was in Amman, Jordan, who came to speak at the invitation of Global Majority in Amman, Jordan, I work with her. She asked me to do things for her, and I do things for her, but I'm not part of the government. So I'm very much in touch with home. My last trip to South Africa was in June, and I have taken with me professors from Sac State, and they wanted to stay in a hotel. I told them that, no, when you go with me to South Africa, you don't stay in a hotel. You're going to stay with me in my mother's house. And it was 8 of them. And they said, all of us in your mother's house? I said, yes. They said, how is it going to be done? I say, you'll see. So, so yeah, they stayed there for their entire stay there. And, you know, it was really very nice because I'm from South Africa and I have connections. And one good thing about having been in the struggle against apartheid, you were born in it, you fought it, you saw apartheid crumble, and then people that you were with in the struggle are now ruling the country. So I was able to give them access to every possible aspect of South Africa and people of South Africa. But then I've been in this country for some time, and what I see about Africa, and then questions that I receive about Africa, and then some of the questions people will ask me, what do Africans want? Because when we look at Africa, it's nothing but wars, flies, conflict, people not being able to get along, animals. Other people even ask me, one young man asked me recently, I let him stay in my house for some time. He was between houses, young, you know, 19, 20. And he kept, and recently, this is funny because it's recent, he was asking me that, Dr. Musubja, do you have animals in Africa, right? I said, yeah, we have animals. And then he said, are you not afraid of them? Don't they beat you? Don't they eat you or something like that? And then I was dumbfounded. You know, I said, well, I thought we were over that. But before I could even answer, he told me about Jamie Foxx, the comedian, who said something about he was afraid to touch a tiger but Africans were just touching tigers. I didn't know what to say to him. You know, he's so young, and I was tired. I didn't want to give a long speech. I said to him, "You are staying in my house with a dog and cat in the house, and you are asking me if we live with animals." You know, so we all live with animals, but you know, tigers and other animals don't roam around. So. But what do Africans want? They want good democratic governance. They want equitable distribution of resources, education, access to health. They want to live well. If they want to live well, then why do we have these conflicts? You know, people can give you examples and say, look at Cote d'Ivoire. It's split into two, the government on one side, the civil society on one side. It seems like there's not going to be any peace. Darfur, the Janjaweed, and the other, you know, people fighting against the Janjaweed fighting against people, and then different organizations bringing themselves together to oppose it, and then they start also having conflicts amongst themselves. Uganda, you look at Somalia, you have to forgive me, I have a cold. I think I have allergies, I have to blow my nose. So, you look at Somalia, which has been fighting for more than 15 years. You look at refugees in the Great Lake area that affects Chad and all the areas around that. You look at Zimbabwe, you know, people will quote Zimbabwe to you, that, you know, Zimbabwe too, there is conflict in Zimbabwe. So there seems to be like, you know, Africans just don't like what I've just said to you that they want. And then these conflicts, right, they destroy everything. People are killed, men, women, and children. The conflicts destroy the social fabric. It destroys the infrastructure. It is impossible for people to have education. It is impossible for people to have access to health. How can you even talk about health while you are trying to survive and save your life? Right? All of these things. What causes these conflicts? What causes these conflicts? Of course, we can't talk about the conflicts of Africa without talking about the legacy of colonialism, right? The legacy, the aftermath of colonialism. Some people like to make it very simple and say, well, colonialism happened a very long time ago. Why are we talking about that? I mean, the first country in Africa to become independent was Ghana, right? Independent was Ghana, and Ghana already celebrated its 50th independence anniversary. Already it did that. But why do you have this? Why do you have Rwanda? But when you look at all of these conflicts also, you see that the influence and the aftermath of the colonial system is still very present. But in addition to that, the leadership of Africa, some of the leaders, they are corrupt, to put it simple. They don't want to give up power, poverty, right? And then some of them, when they are in power, they don't know how to distribute the resources in a way that everybody will have a share. Some of them will misuse and abuse the resources by keeping them to themselves and their friends. That results in poverty. Poverty is a form of violence, and it is more so devastating when I personally see how it affects children, babies, teenagers, and even men and women, adults, when you see poverty does that. But not only that, poverty creates tension. And then the tension, what type of tension does it create, right? People, when they are hungry, people, when they want to survive, the possibility of them committing crimes is very high. Then they commit crimes. And then also, you know, the committing crime, well, you know, the presence of crime also destroys the fabric of the fabric of a society. So those are the problems that Africa is facing. Rwanda, look at the Rwanda case. In 1994, when South Africa was celebrating its first truly democratic, its first democracy, the Rwandans were killing each other in genocide. Everybody was focusing on South Africa. Nobody was, well, most of the people were focusing on South Africa. Very few attention on Rwanda, okay? So why were the Rwandese fighting? Okay, we can say it was between the Tutsi and the Hutu, but also the Belgians and the French were there. They played a part. It was in their interest to see the genocide committed, right? What was said with the Rwandan situation was, when the Western world said that there should be an evacuation, and then when the evacuation happened, I'm just going to be blunt, that if you are black, you remain. If you are white, you should go into the buses. I think what was more devastating for people who care for people, you know, people who are involved in humanity, who happened to have a white face and not a black face, that was most devastating for them. They didn't know what to do, you know. They were pleading with the evacuators that at least let's take the children. But those who were sent to evacuate were very focused, they knew what was their directive, and they were not going to violate that directive. So I have said all those things to you about Africa, you know, very negative things. But also there's good news from Africa. There's good news from Africa. That is why I'm also involved with the Africa Channel. That brings, if you want me to tell you about that also, I will. That brings good news from Africa to the Americas, to the Western world, let me put it that way. South Africa, the country that I come from, I'll talk about that, but it's good news. Angola, Mozambique, Swaziland, Botswana, Lesotho, Zambia, yeah, all those countries, Burundi. I talked about the genocide in Rwanda, but Rwanda right now is a different country. In November, we had a conference at Cal State University, Sacramento. We had a post-genocide Rwanda conference, and I was one of the organizers. We had people from Rwanda and Rwandese from this part of the world and Canada, from different parts of the world and Canada. We talked about what Rwanda or the Rwandese have achieved since 1994, well, after the genocide up to now. And it is amazing, you know, it is amazing. How were they able to come where they are today? Okay. Unlike South Africa, where in South Africa, you know, I'll say boldly that we resolved our own problems. The two ambassadors from Rwanda were telling me, you know, when we were talking during the conference, they were saying to me, you know, Dr. Musubje, for South Africans, it is easy to say truth and reconciliation because you can own it. It is yours, okay? For the Rwandese, we have all these debates because truth and reconciliation, yes, it's a good concept. It should be replicated throughout the world. But you also have to deal with the fact that it is not from Rwanda, it's from South Africa, right? So the Rwandese, they involve the international world, right? The international mediators, the international world. But they also came up with their own indigenous way of resolving their conflict, which is called gachacha. Gachacha simply means when people had a conflict, they would say, let's go sit on the grass and talk. That's what it means, right? So they incorporated that in their attempt and effort to resolve the genocide conflict. The conference that we had was the third one. You know, it was the third of a series of conferences. The one that we had before this year was very interesting because the younger Rwandese did not have a problem with the truth and reconciliation. They said it would be fine for them to have the truth and reconciliation. But, you know, the older people, and some of them were the Rwandese who were in the U.S. if have never been home, they wanted truth, justice, and reconciliation. Okay? You know, with Africa, I'll say that with Africa, people are very sensitive to be dictated to. People are very sensitive to that, to be dictated to. They feel it's their problem and they'll resolve it. Do they want others to be involved? I'll say, yeah, they do. But you have to know how to approach them. Look at Zimbabwe, for instance. The struggle in Zimbabwe. What is the struggle in Zimbabwe? The Western world, when they talk about what Mugabe is doing, they don't talk about the Lancaster House Agreement that was supposed to be put in place in 1990, after 10 years. The Lancaster House Agreement was an agreement of distributing the land back to the Zimbabweans. They allowed the white Zimbabweans to hold on to the land, but after 10 years, they needed to sell it back to the government and give it back to the people. That did not happen. And then in 2000, sometimes it's difficult for people to understand. If you have been in the struggle, fought in the struggle, got your independence, and then people who are negotiating tell you that, look, you know, in order for us to move forward, we need to have a transition that will balance things. So we can wait for 10 more years, right, while our fellow whites are deciding how we are going to get back the land. Then 10 years passes. And then 1990 becomes 2000. And then people say, we are tired. We want back the land. And what they did was they started occupying these different parts and, you know, and then it became very, very, it became about a global world spot on Zimbabwe. Recently, I was with the man who's going to be the next president of South Africa, Mr. Zuma. This was on December 4th from December 4th. So as he was talking, we went to different places with him, the Consul General and I. And then, of course, people asked him about Zimbabwe, about South Africa's silence diplomacy in Zimbabwe, right? I was listening to him explaining to people. He was saying that, listen, all these things that you want to tell Mugabe, we want to tell him too. We want to tell him to not take freedom of the press away from people. We want him to have fair elections. We want to tell him all of these things. But before we go and tell him, then Bush says something, Blair says something. You think Mugabe is going to listen to Blair and Bush? He's not. He's not going to do that. Why? Because of the history. He fought in the struggle. He was taken to jail for 10 years. He lived in the bush for 10 years, and they did some personal things that I'm hesitant to share. The torture and everything. So he's sensitive to being dictated by a foreign force that used to be the colonizer. So he was saying that South Africa is doing more in terms of silence diplomacy than the world is doing. So he said it will help if people just keep quiet and then don't, you know, and then they let, you know, Africans maybe talk to a fellow South African. Find a way of, if you can help it, not say anything Blair, not say anything Bush, and then let other people say it. And then he was saying, he also said that when they were talking to Mugabe, Mugabe said, listen, you are criticizing me, and then, you know, Britain and the United States are criticizing me. I held elections, criticized the elections, but I held them. I was elected by my people. Bush was not. so he said, So how do you respond to that? How do you respond to that? Are we saying Mugabe should be in power? I don't think somebody should be in power for such a long time. It's a long time. It's a long time. You should go. But also the other thing that was interesting that he shared was when they were talking to Mugabe about, yeah, that there are many Zimbabweans who are qualified to take over. He disqualified each one of them. He went through the list disqualifying each one of them. So Mugabe must really, I believe that he must go. But those are the things that we have to put to keep in mind when we are talking about Africa. As South Africa, we are, South Africa, the racial apartheid system in South Africa was horrible. I don't know how to explain it. It was horrible. I'm a South African. I lived it. My life is, I was born in apartheid. I fought apartheid. I experienced loss to apartheid. I saw apartheid crumble. What a wonderful life, okay? I saw apartheid crumble. And then now there's a new South Africa, right? People still stop me in the street and ask me, how did you do it? How was it possible for South Africa to be what it is today? I'm not saying South Africa is perfect, okay? That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is South Africa is, South Africa has achieved a lot. South Africa has. And we don't have what is happening in Kenya right now. Kenya was one of the peaceful countries in Africa, and see what is happening in Kenya right now. We don't have the conflicts that are happening in other parts of Africa. For me, South Africa is good news, okay? For me, South Africa is good news. The truth and reconciliation was a part that made South Africa be what it is today. I need to talk about that because most of the time people say the truth and reconciliation is a Christian solution. It means forgiveness, that people have forgiven people. I love Bishop Tutu very much. But the truth and reconciliation doesn't come from Tutu. The truth and reconciliation doesn't come from Tata Mandela, from Mandela. The truth and reconciliation comes from the people of South Africa. That's the context. And then let me share this with you. I will write about this. I have written many books. In one of my books, I make reference, but it's just a small reference to this. But I will write a book one day very soon about the history of the truth and reconciliation, the origin of the history of the truth and reconciliation from the civil society, from the ordinary people of South Africa. During the struggle to maintain apartheid, the apartheid government would detain people. Right? It would detain people, torture them, and then the methods of torturing, some of them, you will be told that your loved one has died because he jumped from the 14th floor. He was escaping from the 14th floor. He died because he was, he went on a hunger strike. I don't know if a hunger strike kills people, but they made us believe that it did, or he slipped. And then they would also torture people. And then that torture would manifest in putting plastic bag over somebody's, a plastic bag here full of water, and then electrocute your ears, your private parts, beat you up, okay? They would do all those kind of things. And then what I had through my lifetime in South Africa It will be people, you know, different kinds of stories that I will hear, people telling me that I was never detained, I was never taken to detained, but I have relatives, friends, people close to me who were detained, including my brother who was 12 at the time. We lost him this past March, who was 12 at the time, who they made sleep with a corpse for 2 days. And of course, we didn't know where he was for 2 years. Okay, and then when he came out, then, you know, he told us all those things. But, you know, in all of these things, when they relate to you, people who have been detained, who have been tortured, of course, I have seen the police beating up my father because he didn't have a passbook. I've experienced police coming when I was young, police coming to the house, security police, you know, coming to the house, knocking on all the doors and windows and coming in and then, you know, looking everywhere, even in the drawers. I remember asking my mom, what are they looking for? My mom said to me, they are looking for your uncle and your grandfather. I said, in the drawers, you know? So, but, you know, that was how we lived during that time. So when people come out from being tortured, they would tell you that some of the stories that you'd hear is people would say that, you know, sometimes when you looked into the eyes of these people who were torturing you, some of them would break and say, we really don't want to do this, but we don't have a choice because you're going to do to us what we did to you. And then, well, let me say, when people say to me, South African blacks were nice because, you know, they forgave this, I said, some of the things that they would say, I'm going to tell you, but they wouldn't say them nice. They would say that, you know, you are torturing me, kill me, you won't kill all of us. But who the hell do you think you are to tell me that I'm going to do to you what you did to me? You think you are my hero? You think I'm looking up to you? You're very arrogant. I'm not in the struggle to be like you. I'm in the struggle to be a different person. So don't fool yourself. I don't want to be like you. Okay? So, you know, when people keep on hearing this over and over and over again, okay? But then earlier on, I told you about how people were tortured and killed, and then the report that we got that, we killed your son because he was a terrorist throwing stones at the police. We killed your brother or your husband or your uncle because he was defeating the ends of justice. He was interfering with justice. Well, your relative died because he went on a hunger strike or he hung himself, right? We knew it was a lie. So it was very important for people to know the truth long before the name Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Long before that concept was taken and institutionalized to all of our benefit, to all of South Africa's benefit. Then it became institutionalized, as it happens all the time. You know, we can demonstrate against war, put pressure on the government to stop war. If Bush stops war, will they say that the civil society in Santa Cruz put pressure on Bush? No, you are not going to get credit at all. The news media is not going to talk about you at all. They are going to talk about, oh, Bush, and, you know, credit him with everything. He will get an A+, even though he got a C- at Princeton or wherever he attended a school. So it is the same thing, that now the truth and reconciliation was institutionalized. Then people think about Well, it's because it is related to Christianity. Reconciliation is related to Christianity. I want to offer you that. Wanting to know the truth and wanting to reconcile with your fellow human being, right, doesn't necessarily have a religious connotation. It comes from what Bill was telling you about Ubuntu, your humanity. Let me tell you that when I was in South Africa, and then we woke up and then we would be surrounded by white South Africans, young white South Africans who were my age at the time, okay, with their guns and their military, and they looked very mean, you know. And, you know, they considered themselves as being the custodians of apartheid system. And then that we were afraid of them, okay? You looked in their eyes, they have been there day after day after day after day. A cup of tea, taking a cup of tea to them, exposed their humanity, their vulnerability, to a point where they said, why are you doing all of this? Why can't you just be peaceful? Why can't you just be peaceful? And then you get an opportunity. I'm telling you the truth. This is the history of South Africa. I'm not talking about governments. I'm talking about human beings. Then we said, this is before I came to the U.S. We said, why are you here? I'm here because you are not peaceful people. You don't want to practice your culture. Is that why you are here? Yeah. No, you know, it's not because I don't want to practice my culture, but it's because of apartheid. Then a dialogue begins, informal negotiation begins. I have to blow my nose, sorry. Then, you know, in the process, then they ask themselves, why do you live in conditions like this? And then you start explaining, because of apartheid system. And then they begin to understand apartheid system from a different perspective. Rent a movie called Children of Apartheid. And then there you will see, it was made in the 1980s, you will see and hear young white South Africans saying, I don't want to go into the military and come back and kill my fellow white South Africans. Okay? I don't want to go into the military and kill my fellow white South Africans. And these were the mean people who were around every time. Then they started playing football, because they were men, football with men, made sure that we gave them tea, warm food. They relaxed. They were there and then they relaxed, not killing us anymore. Then what happened? The government became very angry. What is happening there? What is happening then? Then they sent the police. Then we saw what I call white-on-white violence. I'm saying that deliberately because people never say that. So I'm just saying that. So laugh. I'm saying that. So you see, the police and the military fighting each other. Actually, the men in the military saying, just go away, we are in charge, we don't need you here, go back, right? Some of the things, the tactics that we engaged was, do the police are bothering you? Yes, they are bothering us. We don't know, you don't know what to do here. You can dig ditches and then they'll fall into the ditches when they come. They did that, that's true. Some of the things was, you know, the fruit pear, P-E-A-R. They bought fruit, the pear, and then they would throw it at the police and say, hand grenade, but it was not hand grenade, and the police would retreat, you know. So things like those, tactics like those. But then the most fundamental, I mean, it leads to that. It's those little things that are non-violent, that seem stupid, that seem senseless. that led to the young white South Africans forming end conscription campaign. Talking to their brothers, they were already in the military, but talking to their brothers, their cousins, not to join the military. So the government was losing control, all because of the power of civil society. Okay. So the Truth and Reconciliation then, it had several divisions. One part was you applied for amnesty, and then your case was read. And if the crime was committed, and it was if the crime was politically motivated, it didn't matter whether the crime was committed when you were maintaining that system that was a crime against humanity, or you were fighting that system. South Africans decided that it should be equal. Unfair to the world, you know, people ask me, how could it be? Because it was self-defense, you were defending yourself. I'll say to you that it is hard for me to explain to people who have not gone through the apartheid system, for me to explain to them. But one thing that you need to understand is we all have Ubuntu. You want me to explain what Ubuntu is? Always when we try to explain Ubuntu, we say that the English word does not, there's no English word that fully captures the meaning of Ubuntu. The humanity, you know, my humanity is affirmed by you. I cannot be fully human if you are not affirming me. See, that's, I really don't know how to explain it in English. I can easily say, motho ke motho ka batho. I'll translate. I'm a human being because you are a human being. Yeah, I'll say that. So the Truth and Reconciliation was based on that. If your case was, the prosecutor decided that it was politically motivated, then the perpetrator and the victim came and listened to each other, and then they told their stories, and then there was the investigating unit that will go and check out the story. If the story checked out, then you received amnesty. Amnesty meant that you are freed from civil and criminal liability. And then if your story didn't check out, then you were subject for prosecution, okay? A lot of South Africans went through the Truth and Reconciliation. Did everybody want to do that? No, not everybody. South Africa is diverse. People have diverse thoughts. Did the majority of South Africans agree to the Truth and Reconciliation? Yes, they did. And then South Africa is what it is today. This year we'll be celebrating our 14th anniversary. We have had President Mandela. President Mandela stayed for one term. He could have stayed for two, but a statement that he is, and a good example that he is to the rest of Africa, he said only one term. I need to talk about another white South African, a very good example, who's de Klerk. Okay, de Klerk. De Klerk could have stayed in government too, but halfway through the way, he said, I have been here for a long time. Let me give others a chance. He stepped down. So we have two good examples in South Africa. So whatever you say about us, we are good news. That's how, whatever you say about us, we are good news. We have Thabo Mbeki, you know, he served two terms. And what happened in South Africa was, what happened recently, I don't know if you're following what's going on in South Africa. He stood for election to be the president of the party. A president of the party then becomes the president of the country. The constitution says you can only serve 2 terms. My opinion, and I'm just going to say it, he should not have stood up. Because he should not have stood up for nomination because he has served his 2 terms. The ANC, the ruling party, is very strong, 70-something percentage representation. It doesn't have a viable majority that will say, no, you are not going to change the constitution. But what happened in South Africa recently, the ANC formed within itself an opposition that said, no, we are not going to allow any leader to manipulate the constitution as the ANC. It said no, and then he was not elected as the president of the ANC. We are good news. We really are good news. Yeah, but I don't know how long I have spoken, but I would like to stop and then take questions, if you have questions from the audience. Yes.